Great. So morning, everyone, and welcome to our latest webinar, Different States of Mind. Before I introduce our speakers for today, I just want to mention a couple of other events. Next week, we're running a treasure hunt in Leeds City Centre. There's still time to get involved and book a team in for what promises to be a really fun event. So please get involved if you're interested in that. Also, we took the decision to postpone the annual dinner, which usually takes place at the end of October. However, we've rebooked for the 17th of March, and the invitation to book tables will be coming out in the next month or so. We'd love to see as many of you there as possible, so please watch out for that, and hopefully we can see you in person. You'll receive emails asking for feedback from today's session, so please let us know what you think, and also any ideas for topics that you'd like us to cover moving forwards. As well as technical topics, please let us know if you've got any ideas for other social events or even charity fundraising events you'd like to see. We're keen to arrange a charity event to support our partner charities, the insurance charities and Touchstone. So we'd welcome any ideas that you might have, however weird and wonderful they might be. Moving back to today's event, we're delighted to welcome Katie Carney and Scarlett Cates of Brown Jacobson, who'll be sharing their expertise on digging down into concepts like the difference between what a reckless breach and what's a deliberate breach. They'll be looking at recent case law and applying this to actual claims. I'm really looking forward to what promises to be a really technical but quite interesting subject. So over to you, Katie and Scarlett.
Hello, thank you very much for that. And I'll just briefly introduce ourselves as to, you know, who we are. So we're from Brown Jacobson. I'm a policy wordings manager specialising in drafting and advising on policy wordings and all associated documents. I also happen to be a council member on our local Nottingham Insurance Institute. So I have that link as well. And then Scarlett is an associate solicitor working in our financial and professional risk team, dealing predominantly with the defence of professional negligence claims. So that's us. So I'll just move on to the objective for this session. So our aim today is to learn about the persuasive impact of the findings from the case of Burnett or Grant, an international insurance company of Hanover Limited. It's actually that case that sort of started, you know, this presentation as to, you know, the findings that came out of that. And then we just expanded on looking at different things. So we're also going to look and understand the differences and similarities between various states of mind, so such as deliberate, dishonest, reckless, but within an insurance context. This is going to include pre and post policy inception states of mind. So that could be a careless breach of the duty of fair presentation as opposed to a reckless or deliberate breach, what are reasonable precautions, and other things. We're also going to touch on the language used in the Insurance Act 2015 and SIDRA 2012 so that we can distinguish between the two, because there are some similarities and some differences. And then we're going to develop the knowledge by applying some of these concepts to some example scenarios we've got for you at the end. So I thought I'd start off with looking at some of the natural meanings that some of these words have. A judge said in a case that's not too significant to the scenarios we're looking at, that the words of the policy must be given their ordinary meaning and reflect the intention of the parties in the commercial sense of the agreement. So I thought it'd be good to go over some of those natural meanings, because they are what would be used if, you know, there isn't actually anything defined in any of the acts that we're going to look at. So here's some of the words we've got. Recklessness, which is a lack of regard for the danger or consequences of one's actions. We've got deliberate, which is something done consciously and intentionally. We've got carelessness, which is a failure to give sufficient attention to avoid harm or errors. We've got negligence, which is a failure to take proper care over something. Dishonesty, which is deceitfulness shown in someone's character or behaviour. Reasonable, which is having sound judgment, fair and sensible. and knowledge, awareness or familiarity by experience of a fact or situation. So some of those will, you know, be used by the courts in some of the scenarios that we'd look at, or if an act has a specific definition. So for our purposes, it's really important to establish where and what circumstances these states of mind are being used. So is it under the Insurance Act? Is it under CIDRA? Is it pre-insurance or post-inception? Because they'll have different meanings depending on which situation we're looking at. Is the word we're looking at and the state of mind between the insured and the insurer, or is it between the insured and a third party? Because again, they'll have different meanings. So on that basis, I'm just going to hand over to Scarlett to look at the case of Burnett or Grant.
Thank you, Katie. And I just wanted to say good morning to everybody and thank you so much for attending today. So Katie has introduced this particular case, Burnett or Grant versus the International Insurance Company of Hanover Limited, also known as Inter Hanover. And this is a case in which an appeal, quite an important appeal, was handed down on the 23rd of April 2021. And so it is quite topical in the insurance world, and it certainly has been this year. And this has prompted the requirement for today's training. And some of you may be aware of it already, but I will just run over some of the facts as to this case. So Mr. Grant was sadly killed on the 9th of April 2013 following an assault by Mr. Marquis. Mr. Marquis was a door steward. He was employed by Prospect Security Limited, who was working at the Tonic Bar in Aberdeen at the time. Mr. Grant died by mechanical asphyxiation following a neck hold, which Mr. Marquis performed upon Mr. Grant when he was trying to restrain him when he was leaving the Tonic Bar in Aberdeen. Mr. Marquis went to trial for the death of Mr. Grant, and at the trial, the jury did not accept that Mr. Marquis had actually caused Mr. Grant's death, and he was actually convicted of assault, not murder. It was accepted by the sentencing judge that Mr. Marquis's actions were badly executed, but not badly motivated. Now, I want you to remember the wording that was adopted by the sentencing judge during the trial, because this does have some conclusions and some bearings on the on his state of mind during the assault. And in particular, it's worth noting that it was agreed by the court that Mr. Marquis did not intend to kill Mr. Grant. So this all goes to what was Mr. Marquis's state of mind at the time of the events. So Prospect, the door security company, they had a public liability policy with Inter Hanover. Sorry, Katie, if you could just switch to the next slide, please. Thank you. So they had a public liability policy with Inter Hanover, and in this policy excluded liability arising out of deliberate acts. So if a claim was made against Prospect for an injury caused by somebody, by one of Prospect's employees, and that act that caused the injury was deliberate, then that would be excluded from cover. Prospect were vicariously liable for the acts of Mr. Marquis. However, they actually went into liquidation at the time. And so under the Act, as you may be aware, Mrs. Grant, who was the widow of Mr. Grant, she was able to bring a claim directly against the insurers into Hanover rather than Prospect as the insolvent defendant. So she brought a claim against into Hanover for the injury caused, injury and death of her husband, Mr. Grant. So under the Third Party Rights and Insurers Act 2010, the right to be indemnified was transferred and vested to Mrs. Grant under the Act. Inter Hanover actually sought to have the claim dismissed, as they claimed they were not liable to indemnify a Prospect, as Mr. Marquis's actions fell within the exclusion of deliberate acts. Further, Inter Hanover argued that the liability for wrongful arrest was limited to £100,000. And we're just going to focus on the deliberate acts exclusion for the purpose of today's training, but I thought it was just important to add in their second limb of their argument for declining the claim. Mrs. Grant, in first instance, actually succeeded in her claim, and she argued that the exclusion did not apply. And it was actually the Lord Ordinary who concluded that there had been no deliberate acts by Mr. Marquis on the facts of the case, and the wrongful arrest extension was inapplicable. Inter Hanover appealed the case, and it was actually heard by the Supreme Court on the 8th of February of this year. So the main issue before the Supreme Court was, is the insurer entitled to rely on an exclusion under the policy of liability arising out of deliberate acts of an employee? Inter Hanover, they claimed that deliberate acts were acts which are intended to cause an injury, or acts which are carried out recklessly as to whether or not they will cause injury. Mrs. Grant's case was that deliberate acts meant acts which are intended to cause a specific injury, which results in this case death, or at least serious injury, but that on any view, it does not include deliberate acts. The Supreme Court, when considering whether or not the exclusion should apply, made reference to a couple of points that should be taken into consideration when interpreting the exclusion clause. As Katie has already pointed out, the Supreme Court said that the policy should be interpreted objectively by asking what a reasonable person would have understood the language of the contract to mean. And so in this case, we need to be thinking about, well, what is the purpose of the public liability insurance? And what is the commercial aim of this insurance as well? So let's dissect this in a bit more detail. So the business acts of Prospect as a door security company, they were door security contractors. They had doormen at the doors of bars. There is obviously a risk that doormen would use a certain degree of force when carrying out their duties, and Prospect would then be liable for those tortious acts if a claim was to follow. Some incidents of the doormen may be careless, and therefore public liability cover was there to protect them and to cover them for such incidents at the doors of bars. If we were to strip away that completely and apply it with a very strict view, then the policy would be completely pointless. And so it's very important, and I think particularly in this case, was to look at the purpose of the public liability insurance cover, particularly what did Prospects understand their cover to mean at the time that they entered into the contract. So let's have a look at what the court actually concluded in this case. The court actually accepted Inter Hanover argument, and that was that deliberate acts means acts which are intended to cause injury. But they actually rejected the argument that the clause extends to recklessness. And they actually said that Inter Hanover had provided absolutely no evidence that deliberate also includes recklessness. And to include recklessness within the definition of deliberate would undermine the purpose of the cover provided. It would mean that the cover would, and the exclusion in particular, would be very wide and commercially unsatisfactory. And again, that just goes back to what we were discussing on the previous slide. Whilst the court accepted that it meant acts which are intended to cause injury, they actually rejected Mrs. Grant's argument, which was that deliberate acts means acts which are intended to result in a specific injury. The court didn't accept that. They said that it was impossible to cover claims for an intention to cause a specific injury because you can't predict what specific injury will arise from an act. So for example, a doorman punches a man in the face and he intends to break his nose. If the doorman succeeds in breaking the nose, then the exclusion would apply because he intended to break his nose, this being the specific act. But if a doorman punches a man in the face, but the man actually falls to the ground and he ends up suffering a more serious injury, if we were to apply Mrs. Grant's argument that a deliberate act means an act resulting in a specific outcome, then the exclusion wouldn't apply because the doorman didn't intend to cause this specific injury. And again, the court decided that was not satisfactory. Again, as Katie's already mentioned on the first slide, the court looked at the natural meaning of deliberate. What did this mean? And this means conscious performance of an act intending its consequences. And so applying the findings of the trial from Mr. Marquis, if you remember, he was actually convicted of assault, not murder. The court concluded that there was no evidence that Mr. Marquis had an intention to cause injury, just an assault. And so the court actually concluded that the exclusion did not apply. The courts did not find Mr. Marquez had intentionally injured Mr. Grant, and Mr. Marquez's actions were badly executed, but not badly motivated. I'm just going to move over to Katie now, who's going to have a discussion about some pre-insurance cover concepts.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, as Scarlett said, we're going to look at the duties that an insured has when taking out cover. So for non-consumers, that's going to be under the Insurance Act, and for consumers, that's going to be under SIDRA. These duties vary in expectations of the insured, and it's important to show what state of mind they had or what was required and expected of them. This helps us establish whether there have been any breaches or if the insurer has any remedies available to them based on what type of breach that has occurred. So I'm going to look at the Insurance Act and the duty of fair presentation. This was one of the biggest changes that the Act brought about. And it was that the insured must now give this, a fair presentation of the risk. I'm not going to go into every element of this, just the parts that relate to state of mind. But a duty of fair presentation is a presentation that discloses in a manner that is reasonably clear and accessible every material circumstance which is known or ought to be known following a reasonable search, or if it provides sufficient information to put a prudent insurer on notice that it needs to make further inquiries. So as I said, I'm going to break this down now to look at the different elements of that. So looking at knowledge and reasonableness, it goes on. So in that definition, it said it's what's known or ought to be known. So the Act goes on to say that it's not just actual knowledge, but also matters which the individual suspected and would have been knowledge, but for deliberately refraining from confirming. So basically, if someone turns a blind eye to information, that really should have been within their knowledge, then that would be included within what ought to have been known. What should an insured know? It's the actual knowledge of an insured's senior management, which are those individuals who play significant roles in the making of decisions about how the insured's activity are to be managed or organised. It's also information held by those arranging insurance, so such as the broker, but that wouldn't include confidential information specific to an individual, because obviously that wouldn't be something that the broker would be expected to know. And then it would also be matters that the insured suspected and would have been in their knowledge. So what should an insurer know? The insurer is presumed to know what is within common knowledge or information a specialist insurer or broker would be expected to know. So if it's something that you'd be expected to know within your field, even if that information isn't disclosed, but it's quite obvious the risk that you're dealing with, it would be that sort of information. So then also within that definition, there is a reasonable search. Now, there's no definition under the Act of what a reasonable search is. It very much, I think, is going to come down to the circumstances and risk at hand. And it could be quite potentially an onerous task. So let's say you've got a company that has over 4,000 employees across numerous countries. What would be a reasonable search in that circumstance? And I think it's for that sort of scenario that the reason there is no definition within the Act, because otherwise you could be placing an onerous task on a company like that. And so therefore, I think we're going to look at sort of the natural meaning of reasonableness. And I think it's going to be circumstance and risk dependent and proportionate to the size, nature and complexity of the business. Similar commentary elsewhere has basically said the same thing. So it means that if you've got a smaller business with little information available, but some of that is going to be quite imperative, then if it's easily readily available to you, then you'd be expected to be disclosing that information because you'd be able to find it upon a reasonable search. So then moving on, I'm just going to look at the remedies available under the Insurance Act for a breach of fair presentation. I thought it'd be important to go over the remedies to demonstrate the importance of being able to determine the insured's state of mind, because this directly impacts on the remedies that are available to them. So the Act says that if a breach is deliberate or reckless, then the insurer may avoid the policy and retain the premium. In all other circumstances, the remedy will be dependent on what would have happened had the duty been complied with. So, i.e., would the insurer have entered into the contract on the same terms that they did? So the Act aims to restore the insurer to the position that they would have been in had the insured fulfilled their duties by way of these sort of proportionate remedies. So then sticking with deliberate or recklessness, I'm going to look at what a breach is. So a breach for which the insurer has a remedy is called a qualifying breach. And under the Act, a qualifying breach is either deliberate or reckless, or on the flip, neither deliberate or reckless. The Act says it is for the insurer to show that a qualifying breach was deliberate or reckless. So how do we go about showing this? So the Act says that an insured will have acted deliberately if they knew that it did not make a fair presentation. An insured will have acted recklessly if they did not care whether or not they were in breach of that duty or not. So in this instance, did not care is intended to indicate a greater degree of culpability than acting carelessly. So basically more than mere negligence. So despite the language almost suggesting that the insured is required to know the provisions of the Act, really non-disclosure will be found to have been deliberate where the insured was aware that it possessed material that should have been disclosed to the insurer because it was patently obvious that it was something that you'd expect the insurer to know within the context of the risk, the questions that were being asked, and the cover that they were asking for. It's also important to know that deliberate or reckless will include fraudulent behaviour. So the Act didn't go about including fraud as a, within the definition, because the Law Commission said that many insurers associated the term with criminal standards of proof. But pre-contractual fraud will therefore be considered as deliberate or reckless breach of duty of fair presentation. The Act does contain separate rules in relation to fraudulent claims made after the policy is concluded, but this is just in respect of sort of pre-conceptual concepts. So in the Law Commission's report on the Act, they said that it wasn't their intention that as a result of sort of this definition, as a result of what qualifies as a qualifying breach, it wasn't their intention that the insurer's task of proving that a breach of duty of fair presentation was deliberate or reckless was unduly onerous or require an exceptionally high standard of proof. So they didn't want that to be the case. In terms of what amounts to reckless, the Law Commission's quite helpfully said that it's a difficult concept. So basically, pretty much they didn't really want to touch on it. They also commented that it requires a lack of interest in making a fair presentation, perhaps almost a complete disregard for the quality of the presentation. So again, it's still more than mere carelessness or recklessness. And the Law Commission actually concluded to say that the definition of recklessness is best left to the court. So, you know, it may be the courts look to define it at some point, but I think it's more that it's just going to be on a case-by-case basis. So now moving on to SIDRA and the duties and remedies under that Act. So deliberate or reckless definition in the Insurance Act actually echoes that which was within SIDRA. However, in SIDRA, a qualifying breach must either be deliberate, reckless, or careless. And this is because the consumer's duty is to take reasonable care not to make a misrepresentation to the insurer, which is obviously different to the Insurance Act of Fair Presentation. So where an insurer has been induced by a misrepresentation to enter into an insurance contract, the insurer's remedy will depend on the consumer's state of mind. So if the consumer acted reasonably, the insurers are required to pay the claims. If they acted deliberately or recklessly, then the insurer can avoid the policy. And for careless misrepresentations, the insurers are titled to a compensatory remedy. So again, it's really important that we can establish what state of mind they had, because you're going to want to know whether you can avoid a claim or whether you've got to pay it. So the Act provides that when deciding whether a consumer has taken reasonable care not to make a misrepresentation, all relevant circumstances must be taken into account. The Act goes on to list some example factors that may need to be taken into account when making a judgment as to whether reasonable care was taken. And it can include any of the following. So we've got the type of consumer insurance contract in question, and this includes its target market, any relevant explanatory material or publicity produced or authorised by the insurer, how clear and how specific the insurer's questions were. Because if the questions weren't clear, it's going to be difficult to show that the insured was able to give any detail with any level of clarity if those questions were unclear. So then, also, how clear the insurer communicated the importance of answering any renewal or variation questions, and whether or not an agent was acting for the consumer will be taken into account. This list is only indicative and therefore non-exhaustive, and other factors may be taken into account where suitable, again, depending on the risk, the business, and you know, all the relevant factors. The test when looking at whether the consumer has taken reasonable care is objective. So that is, the standard of care is that of a reasonable consumer. The test does not usually take into account any particular characteristics of the actual consumer, such as age, knowledge of English, or level of understanding. The notion of reasonableness is commonly used. It's commonly used in English law to provide an objective but flexible standard against which any individual's conduct can be measured. So it denotes an average consumer with no special skills or knowledge expected of them. There are exceptions to the Act, as there are always exceptions. So if an insurer was or ought to have been aware of a consumer's particular characteristics or circumstances, then those may be taken into account. But again, it'll depend on the situation at hand. So then, looking at Sidra Steele, at deliberate, reckless, or careless. So a qualifying misrepresentation is deliberate or reckless if the consumer knew that it was untrue or misleading, or they did not care whether it was untrue or misleading, and where they knew that the matter to which the misrepresentation related was relevant to the insurer, or again, they just didn't care whether it was relevant or not. So a consumer acts deliberately if they act with knowledge. So there was a case, Derry and Peak, where it said that a consumer acts recklessly if they act without care and regard for the truth of an answer. So I think this can be distinguished from making a statement which one genuinely believes to be true, but without sufficient care to check the facts. I think that would be a careless misrepresentation. So this is, you know, it's without care and regard to the truth. You could find out the answer, but you just don't care, as opposed to actually thinking the information you provide in is true because you've not necessarily checked, but you think, oh, I don't need to check because I am right in the information I'm giving. in this context, careless is being used in a special sense. The Act makes clear that a qualifying misrepresentation is careless if it's not deliberate or reckless. So it's quite easy in that sense. If you can't show that it's deliberate or reckless, it's going to be careless. So that's a lot of information to give you on pre-insurance sort of concepts and states of mind under the Insurance Act and CIDRA. So I thought I'd just go over just sort of like a bit of a checklist to add in some brief points so you can ensure you're doing what you should be doing in those initial sort of stages. Quite simple, hopefully stuff you're already doing. So it's just making sure that the questions being asked at the outset are clear and specific, because if they aren't, then it's going to be difficult to show the insured state of mind in respect of when they've answered those questions and the information they've provided. Making sure that you can show, if the information was provided accurately, that you would have done something differently. So I think it's really important to have sort of, you know, guides on factors that are taken into account when making the decisions, because if you can show, well, if I was given this, I would have done this, I would have taken this approach, and if you have that information within underwriter guides and the like, you're going to be able to show you would have done something differently. Another one is just know your industry. You're expected to know something that is common knowledge or ought to be known if you're offering insurance in a certain class. So if it's something that you should have known, then again, it's going to be put on you. And then as a broker, you need to be sure you're providing the insurer with everything that they need, or asking the insured for more information. Because if the insurer wasn't given information that you just didn't ask for, then obviously that's going to be an issue when it comes to looking at what state of mind the insured had. And now I'm going to hand over to Scarlett to look at some post-insurance concepts.
Thank you, Katie. So I just thought it would be helpful for us to have a think about what we learnt, or what we've learnt from the case of Burnett or Grant, which was the case I spoke about earlier. And these are points to consider when you as an insurer or a broker have received a notification from an insured, there's already a policy in play, that contract has been taken out already, and there may be a question mark as to whether or not the claim is covered and whether or not an exclusion, particularly pertaining to an insured state of mind, you may be considering, insurers may be considering, well, does this apply? I think one of the main things that we learnt from the case of Burnett or Grant was that the courts continue to apply a narrow interpretation to the exclusion clauses. They are not likely to apply a wide interpretation. Again, we go back to the whole point about ensuring that the point of the insurance cover is commercially sound. And because of this narrow interpretation, it's making it increasingly difficult for insurers to rely on their exclusions. And I think a tip would be to ensure that exclusions should be defined with plain and ordinary language. The reason for that is that the courts, which we already know and have talked about at length already during this discussion, is that the courts will apply the ordinary meaning of deliberate, reckless, willful neglect. And it is this ordinary interpretation that the courts will apply. So we have to be thinking about, well, what is the natural meaning of the words deliberate? So deliberate, a conscious act, conscious performance of an act intending its consequences, recklessness, lack of regard for the danger or consequences of one actions, deliberate and recklessness, as we learned from the case of Burnett Ware, are different, and they're not intended to mean the same thing. To do so would make that exclusion very wide. Recklessness is different to deliberate because it is carrying out an act which an insured is aware of that what he is doing risks damage, but he does it anyway. an important point to be looking at and considering is what would a reasonable person with all the background knowledge, which would have reasonably been available to the parties when they entered into the contract, would have understood the language of that contract to mean. So again, what was the purpose of the policy? What did the policyholder understand the meaning of the policy to mean at the time that they took it out, having regard to all of the knowledge that they had at that time or reasonably would have been available to them? And again, that just goes to the commercial purpose of the policy. As we know, each case has a bearing on its own facts. And so I think it's very important to know your client, know the claim. And really, it's a fact-finding exercise for you as insurer, as a broker. Gather as much evidence as you can and pass this on to insurers so that when they are considering whether or not an exclusion applies, they have all the relevant information in front of them to make that decision. Because considering coverage, as we've probably found out from this talk, it is technical and much of it depends on the specific context. One of the points which I just thought would be helpful to touch on would be the reasonable precaution condition, which we often see reference to in the general terms and condition of a policy. Now, the reasonable precaution condition places an obligation on a policyholder to take reasonable precautions to prevent against accident or injury, or to protect property from loss or damage. And insurers can refuse cover if insurers do not comply with this general condition. Generally, we need to be thinking about, well, what does a failure to take reasonable precautions mean? And again, we're looking to the state of that insured's mind. The courts have determined that an insurer can only rely on this clause if an insured has been reckless, but not simply negligent in taking reasonable precautions. There's obviously a difference between falling below a standard that would be accepted as reasonable, which is negligence, and recklessness, which is being told or reasonably knowing that you shouldn't do something because it could cause harm or loss and doing it anyway. If a failure to take reasonable precautions was to include negligence, then again, this would defeat the whole object of insurance, because insurance cover is there. For example, professional indemnity insurance is there to cover negligent acts of insureds. And again, it would be far too wide and commercially unsatisfactory to include that definition within reasonable precautions and failure to do so. So what are some examples of a failure to take reasonable precautions? This might be, you know, not fitting a fire alarm in your house or not locking the front door when you leave your house. Perhaps an insured has been advised to repair a building because the building was at risk of collapse, but they failed to do so and the building then fell down. Again, these are all failure to take reasonable precautions to protect their property from harm or loss. I think it's important for us to make a distinction between reasonable precautions and positive obligations on the policy, but my view is that they are quite similar. So for example, there may be an obligation on some building, some commercial building insurance policy that places an obligation on an insured to have a working alarm system, or maybe there's in your home insurance policy, it means that you have to have batteries in your fire alarm. They're all obligations on behalf of the insured. And I think one of the important things, again, practical tips for you to take away, is to ensure that policyholders are aware of their continuing obligations under the policy. You know, draw their attention to the general terms and conditions. It can, you know, it may get lost when you're sort of discussing these with your clients, but it is important that they know that there are these ongoing obligations. And of course, the risk for you, particularly for brokers, is if you aren't drawing your clients to these clauses, to these obligations, and then cover is declined, this could cause exposure for you as the broker as well in being liable if cover is then declined. So all important takeaways just to have a think about. There are some post-insurance considerations for you. Katie and I now have some practical examples to run through, and I think Katie's going to kick us off with one to begin with.
Thank you. So we're going to look at an example scenario of home cover. So I appreciate that we've, again, covered quite a lot within this short space of time. And I'm quite glad it is being recorded, so it gives you the opportunity to go back, and we'll provide the slides for you to sort of look over and sort of digest the information, because, you know, we've used deliberate, reckless and careless that many times, you've probably already forgotten which one applies to which. So we thought it'd be a good idea to go over some examples of what could be considered reckless, deliberate or careless. So in this example, we're going to look at what a Sidra sort of example. So Sophie took out a home insurance policy, and when asked if she had any claims in the last 5 years, she only reported that she had one claim. Following a claim, the insurer discovered that actually she had two claims. Sophie said she'd just completely forgotten about the other claim 3 years prior. She remembered the one that was more recent, but she'd just forgotten about the other one, and it was just out of her mind. So in reality, when it was calculated, she'd actually only paid 60% premium that she should have been paying. So if we look at Sidra, it says that a consumer acts deliberately if they act with knowledge, and they act recklessly if they act without care and regard for the truth of an answer. Now, in this scenario, Sophie genuinely believes that she only had one claim, but she had a lack of care to check the facts. She just didn't think that there was anything to check, basically. So I think in this scenario, we'd be looking at careless misrepresentation. So the insurer would have to pay that claim. They would have to pay that claim, but proportionately to the amount of premium that that Sophie had paid. So then just looking at a non-consumer example, I'm going to look at a cyber cover, given it's very topical at the moment. So James, part of the senior management of a small business, takes out cyber cover. Insurers asked if the company had in place and in force appropriate malware software. James confirms they did have malware software. James disclosed a large volume of documents, including an invoice for malware software clearly labelled and set out in a summary of other documents, and a very long unnamed internal email chain between various people, including James, on another point of disclosure. But within that note, it said that the software hadn't actually been installed. It had just been purchased, but they hadn't got around to installing it for whatever reason. Following a claim, insurers sought to deny cover, noting that the insured had breached their duty of fair presentation. So in this scenario, what we've basically got is a massive data dump. The Act says that the company must give disclosure in a manner which would be reasonably clear and accessible to a prudent insurer. And I think we can all agree that a data dump is definitely not reasonably clear and accessible. And that was what the Act sought to change. They wanted to deter the practice of data dumping. They were, you know, aware that it was something that happened where people gave large quantities of poorly organized information, you know, in a misguided attempt to protect the company. Obviously this still happens. You can sort of, the Act can try and deter these things, but people are still gonna, you know, sort of do these data dumps. In this instance, James did provide the information they were asking for to show that they had software. And he did, you know, in that email, it did say that it wasn't in use. So it was there at the insurer's availability. But what we would want to establish is whether that presentation was deliberate or reckless, or if it was careless. It's definitely going to be a more challenging task for an insurer to show that a data dump or, you know, insufficiently structured presentation was made deliberately with the knowledge that the presentation was unfair, because it might often be difficult to distinguish such a presentation from one that was prepared negligently and, oh, I need to provide all the information I can, or here it is, you know, I think everything's in there that you need, as opposed to one where they're like, oh, well, we have got malware software, but we haven't installed it yet. Well, here, look, here's an invoice. You can see that we've purchased it. We'll just sort of sneak that other email in that says that it wasn't, because they can see, therefore, that it wasn't installed without us actually drawing their attention to it. So I think we could, in this scenario, maybe establish that it was deliberate, as there was this summary that was provided. It was very clear and it was misleading, because there was a crucial bit of information saying, you know, here we have got this malware software you're asking for, but it's not in force, as you're also asking for. And that was hidden within a mass of documents. So you could maybe show that it was deliberate, especially if you can show that James was sufficiently aware as senior management that it hadn't been installed. So let's say within that chain, that internal email, that he'd interacted, you know, at different points to suggest that he wasn't merely just copied in, because James might argue, oh, well, I provided those emails and everything because I thought they might be important and it related to another point in disclosure, but I'd actually missed that bit about the software not being installed, you know, so it was just completely, you know, innocent of me to have done that. So I think that might prevent
Has everybody else frozen, or is it just my screen?
I think I've lost Katie.
Do we think? Okay.
Yeah, I think it might be Katie.
Okay, let's just give her a moment. Okay, thank you, Louise. Louise, confirm there's a few. Okay, shall I interrupt Katie and just press on with my examples? Is that okay with everybody?
I think that's okay.
Okay.
She resumes. We'll switch back over.
Right, it's just the two of us now. So yes, I will press on. Yes, I just wanted to go through some examples just to sort of recap over what we've learned from, I guess, more of the post-inception concepts and looking at whether or not exclusions apply and what we need to be considering when looking at different states of mind. So you probably can't see my slides here, but I don't think it will matter too much. And anyway, I think they are going to be circulated to everybody. So I will just run through these. So we have in my first example, a buildings and contents insurance policy. Within those general terms and conditions, there is a clause in there which requires the policy holder to take, or it says you must take, reasonable precautions to prevent loss or damage to your property. So the policyholder lights a bonfire during a heat wave. He's been doing some gardening work and he's got all of these trees and sticks that he needs to get rid of. And he decides, I'm going to have a fire to get rid of all of this. But he decides to do it on one of the hottest days of the year. So the fire rapidly spreads and it eventually damages the house. The insured then makes a claim on his buildings and contents insurance to repair the damage. The question is the claim covered, bearing in mind the obligation on the insured to take reasonable precautions to prevent loss or damage to his property? So I think in this situation, and again, this is a fact-finding exercise, so we need to take into account all of the evidence, but it's pretty reckless to have a bonfire in these circumstances. It's the hottest day of the year. I think the insured should have known that there was a risk of fire spreading and potentially causing some damage, but he did it anyway. It's not negligent. It didn't fall below a certain standard, but it was reckless if we think about what the court has determined reckless to mean. And again, applying the ordinary meaning of the word reckless. And so in that situation, I don't think the claim would be covered. The second is a public liability insurance policy, and there is an exclusion in there, very similar to the one that was in the Burnett or Grant case, which excludes liability for any claims arising from deliberate acts. So we've got a similar situation. A doorman punches a patron in self-defense during an altercation as he was removing that patron from the bar. Patron then falls to the floor and he breaks his leg and suffers long-term damage. The doorman goes to trial for committing this injury to the patron. He's actually convicted of GBH. Does the exclusion apply in this situation? Well, let's think about what happened in Burnett or Grant, and let's look at the ordinary meaning of the word deliberate. So was there an intention to cause injury? In this situation, there was an intention to cause injury, even though the doorman was acting in self-defense, he knew that punching the patron in the face would cause him injury. It doesn't matter that he didn't intend to break the patron's leg. The point is that he intended to cause injury. And in this case, the doorman was convicted of GBH. This was very different to the case in Burnett or Grant, because Mr. Marquez didn't intend to cause any injury. He restrained him by putting him in a neck hold. And on those facts, he was convicted of assault and there was no intention to cause injury. Remember, Mr. Marquez's actions were badly executed and not badly motivated. Katie, we have you back with us. Thank you so much. I hope you don't mind me interrupting. I think you're on mute as well, Katie.
I'm really sorry about that.
No problem. I've just been through my example, so I don't know if you wanted to pick up on the, I'm sure we're all waiting to find out the conclusion of the example you provided.
I didn't realise at what point it cut off. Okay, so I'll go back. So on the cyber cover one, I was saying that, you know, you could go down the deliberate route, but I think it would be much easier to prove that he was reckless, that he didn't have, he didn't care if he was in breach or not of that duty, in which case the insurer could avoid the policy. So there, sorry about that. So have you covered all of the clauses now then? So yeah, so that ends our presentation. I'm really glad I cut out near the end rather than midway through, and you know, it's just typical. But does anyone have any questions or answers? Or say, I'll hand over to Melanie anyway.
No problem. Yeah, the best laid plans. It's one of those things, isn't it? There's no accounting for it. Evil technology. Yes, if anyone in the audience has any questions for Katie or Scarlett, feel free to add them into either the chat function or the Q&A and we'll go through those. In the meantime, a big thank you from us in Leeds for joining us. I think Louise is just saying no questions, but great content, thank you. I really found the section where you were going through sort of the difference between reasonable and reckless, etc., and especially the clauses where you were comparing sort of what's come in with the, you know, how that operates in actual fact and the data dumping one, that was quite interesting, because I've had customers that have sort of data dumped to me, and then it's, yeah, what do you do about that? So definitely interesting. Yes, a few more people saying thank yous, but no questions coming through. So we'll just give people a couple more minutes, and then if we don't get any questions through, we'll just say a big thank you and close off, I think.
I mean, if anyone does have any questions that they'd like to ask, you know, outside of here, by all means, there's our contact details. You can give us a call or drop us an email. We're always happy to talk about this and anything else you'd like to talk about. But you know, if you do have any questions, again, after you maybe rewatch it or after you've read the slides or anything like that, we'd be happy to help.
Yeah, just to reiterate, as we mentioned at the beginning, the slides and the recording from today will be on the Leeds Institute website where you went along to book for today. So if you want to get a copy of those slides, just go along there and you'll be able to get those. It will probably take a day or so for